Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
4 years after a government rescue, Fannie Mae is turning in record profits. The head of the Big 12 talks mergers, acquisitions, and college rivalries, and journalism without editors, sort of. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, April 2nd. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us. Let's start out the show today with some news that made us say, really? It's news that mortgage financer Fannie Mae posted record profits in 2012. Just 4 years ago, we were bailing out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the government's been pressured to get out of the housing loan business ever since. Now, today's news could take a little steam out of that argument, but housing has always been a boom and bust sort of business, right? The question is, can we trust the boom? Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
In 2011, Fannie Mae lost $16.9 billion. In 2012, it made a profit of $17.2 billion. Steve Cook is the editor of Real Estate Economy Watch. He says Fannie's record profits are the result of three factors.
Number one, 2012 was a record of all record years for refinancing in the mortgage lending business.
Number two, all those foreclosed houses that were big liabilities to Fannie and Freddie are now valuable thanks to investors who are buying them up in huge numbers.
And then finally, Fannie and Freddie are the only two sources of ways to securitize mortgages today.
So if you're a lender and you want to sell your mortgages to someone else, that's Fannie and Freddie. But despite the record profits, there's still pressure to get the government out of the mortgage business. Guy Sakala is the publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance.
The notion of having a housing-related program that's supporting the mortgage market, homeowners, as well as plowing significant money into the government, makes it much harder to talk about closing them down.
But can we really expect Fannie and Freddie to remain profitable? This is, after all, the housing market, the poster child for boom and bust. Should we believe Fannie and Freddie when they say there's nothing but smooth sailing ahead? Sakala says, yeah, actually, we should, for two reasons. One, they've already worked through most of the problem loans that caused the crisis. And second,
pretty much all the mortgages they've been guaranteeing over the last 2 years are very pristine with very, very low risk characteristics.
Fannie and Freddie's combined profits for 2012 were about $30 billion. Sakala expects that number to double in 2013. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
The Fulton County Jail in Atlanta witnessed a new kind of suspect today, public school teachers and administrators. It's the deadline for educators indicted in a widespread cheating scandal in the Atlanta public schools to surrender or face arrest. 35 in all face charges in an alleged conspiracy to fix test scores in order to get cash bonuses. The superintendent raked in $500,000 alone. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports the case could change the national conversation about high-stakes testing in schools.
To critics who believe standardized testing is out of control, the lesson from Atlanta is clear. The stakes are too high.
Educators are being told that their jobs are on the line, their career, their reputation, their school will be closed if the scores don't go up.
Diane Ravitch is an education historian and leading opponent of test-based school reform. In Atlanta, teachers and principals got bonuses if they raised test scores enough. If they didn't, they could lose their jobs.
I think that the wrong lesson would be to just blame teachers and say it's their fault. They're trapped in a system that is rewarding them for doing the wrong thing.
The anti-testing movement is gaining traction. Earlier this year, teachers in Seattle refused to give their students a widely used standardized test. The district just announced plans to reduce testing and says the teachers won't be punished. Legislators in Texas just passed a bill to limit the number of tests students have to take. Kate Walsh is president of the National Council on Teacher Quality. She says anyone thinking about cheating got a wake-up call this week.
I think the image of 35 people having to walk into a jail this morning and get booked is going to have an incredibly powerful impact on suppressing cheating.
Rather than stop testing, though, Walsh says we need better monitoring and tests that better reflect what teachers are actually teaching. And she says those are on their way from two different state groups. Joan Herman is senior scientist at CREST, a group that studies student testing.
Testing is an important part of school accountability, but we have to be careful on how much emphasis we put on a single indicator.
Like test scores. Herman says any measure of a school's quality should include classroom observations, analysis of student work, and parents who should have a pretty good idea what their children are learning at school. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Cue the happy music. The stock market hit some high notes during the day. We'll have details when we do the numbers. President Obama is set to unveil his budget next week. Once he does that, Congress will have three budget proposals to disagree about: the president's, the Senate's, and the one in the House. And one of the stickiest issues in all of them is that thing we call the social safety net, who it's for and how much to spend on it. Wealth and poverty reporter Chrissy Clark did some digging and found out how that phrase, the safety net, became a household word.
I assumed a safety net historian would know how we started using the phrase safety net, so I called some up and asked.
I'm trying to think. I don't.
That's historian Michael Katz from the University of Pennsylvania.
Maybe Alice O'Connor knows. She probably knows.
I called and she doesn't.
And she doesn't.
Yes.
Well, I don't feel so badly then.
And actually, she was like, you should talk to Michael Katz. Maybe he knows. Katz kept trying to help.
I wonder if Sheldon Danziger knows.
Nope. I'd already tried him, too.
Nobody knows. This is getting more and more interesting.
I'll spoil the suspense here and tell you I eventually found an answer, which I'll get to in a moment, but it needs some context.
This social security measure.
That's Franklin Roosevelt in 1935, after he signed the Social Security Act. You might call it the original American safety net. Until then, taking care of the poor had been mostly a local responsibility. But in the depths of the Great Depression, that got overwhelming. And so FDR launched a raft of federal programs meant to provide
some measure of protection to the average citizen and to his family.
But the big question was exactly which citizens deserved that protection. Linda Gordon, a historian at NYU, says strangely enough, back in 1935, poor single moms and their children were one of the least controversial groups to give aid to. One of the most controversial? Old people.
There were people who strongly criticized the shifting of that burden to the federal government, saying that it would disrupt family values by letting adult children off the hook from caring for their parents.
Old age pensions were so controversial, Gordon says, that FDR decided to give them not just to poor old people, but to middle class and rich ones, too. The more people involved, he thought, the more popular the program would be. But in the midst of these early debates over who belonged in the safety net, no one was actually calling it that.
We had the safety net programs a lot longer than we've had the term.
Guillen McKee is a professor of history at the University of Virginia. The first reference he could find of the so-called social safety net was in an article from 1966, ironically in a quote from FDR's son, FDR Jr.
Quote, public assistance will be envisaged as a safety net on the one hand and as a transmission belt to productive employment and participation in society on the other.
But the phrase didn't really catch on until this moment.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
February 1981, Ronald Reagan's first speech to Congress as president. He was proposing big, controversial budget cuts when he used that phrase, the social safety net. But rather than condemning it, as you might expect a conservative would, Reagan embraced it.
All those with true need can rest assured that the social safety net of programs they depend on are exempt from any cuts.
But then he went on.
But government will not continue to subsidize individuals or particular business interests where real need cannot be demonstrated.
And in that sentence, Reagan popularized a vivid metaphor for government assistance at the same time as he redefined who deserved it. For Reagan, the elderly and veterans were at the top of the list, and the programs he promised not to cut reflected that. Social Security was safe.
Medicare will not be cut. Funding will continue for veterans' pensions.
Things that helped all kinds of Americans, rich and poor. Reagan was more suspicious of programs that required people to prove they were poor, things like food stamps or Medicaid, and he targeted them for cuts. After Reagan's speech, dozens of articles came out talking about the social safety net, and the term stuck. It may seem funny that the speech that launched a thousand safety net metaphors, from shredding to catching, was one that questioned who deserved it. But Guillen McKee, the historian, says that's part of a long tradition.
It's one of the oldest lines in social policy to try to determine who deserves help and who doesn't.
So as a new round of budget debates gears up in Congress,
the House Republican approach would shred the safety net.
We can and should have a safety net, but we don't want to turn that safety net into a hammock.
Keep your ear out not just for which politicians say they care about the social safety net, but who they say it should be there to catch. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
The safety net's been pictured very differently over the years in political comics. If you go to marketplace.org, you can see if a cartoon safety net catches an overweight trapeze artist. You know that you are missing out on some great reads, journalism that never sees the light of day because, well, one person decides it's just not interesting or profitable enough to publish, often an editor. Michael Shapiro is a journalism professor at Columbia, and he is raising money on Kickstarter for a new business model for publishing nonfiction, and it involves crowdsourcing. His startup is called The Big Roundtable. Professor Shapiro, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So give us the 30-second version of the pitch that you have on Kickstarter right now. Explain to us how the Big Roundtable works.
Well, the Big Roundtable is at its core a laboratory. And the question before us that we're hoping to try to make sense of is how people find, read, fall in love with, and share stories. And this is how it works. Somebody sends us a finished story. And we take the first 1,000 words and we show it to 5 people and say, look, do you want to read more or do you want to say no but thanks? If one of those 5 people say, you know, I'd read more, we show it to another 5 to see what the response is. Is there an appetite for this story? Is there a potential audience for the story? The point is, we are ever more in a world in which the default answer is no. Sorry, it doesn't work. Sorry, the financial pressures that we're under won't allow us to publish this otherwise worthy story. We want to see if we can't enhance the chances of getting to yes.
Under this model, if the committee decides this is worthy and then it is published online, the writers will be paid $1 a copy. That means somebody has to click on that story and read it and they'll get a dollar. How'd
right.
you come up with that number? It doesn't sound like much.
No, it doesn't. The micropayment business is really wonderful if you're selling songs that people want forever and want to listen to again and again and again.
Right.
My sense is that going forward, what we're going to embrace is a subscriber/patron model. If 10,000 people want to read it, that's a great thing for that writer, and you will be paid accordingly.
Now, Michael, some writers would tell you that the biggest roadblock to getting stories published is not the gatekeepers, but the paltry pay they're offered at magazines. And, you know, writers just won't submit stories for a couple $100.
That's right. And so our hope is with more subscribers, we can pay writers more money.
Well, the key is getting those subscribers, right?
Right. One of the maxims of the web is, why wasn't I consulted? We want to consult a lot of people. We want to bring people into this conversation. And I hope that that's what's going to set the Big Round Table apart.
Michael Shapiro is a journalism professor at Columbia. His online journalism experiment is called The Big Roundtable. Professor Shapiro, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up,
Even for a league that has the most storied tradition in men's basketball, the majority of the value in their media contracts is driven by the sport of football.
We talked to the commissioner of the Big 12 about changing conferences, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 89.6 tenths percent to finish at 14,662. The NASDAQ charged up 15 points, half a percent, to close at 3,254. The S&P 500 rose 8 points, also half a percent, to settle at 1,570. Humana shot up 5.5%, and United Health gained 4.7%. The federal government will pay more to health insurers who participate in the Medicare Advantage program. Auto sales for March came out today. Ford revved up 0.8 percent. General Motors accessorized with a 0.5% gain. Toyota Motors skidded 1.25%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.86%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. President Obama is scheduled to talk about gun control in Denver. Lace up, tomorrow is National Walking Day. The American Heart Association says it's good for your health. And need to get communication across the country fast? Then you want the Pony Express. At least you did back in 1860 when the service got its start. Letters were carried from St. Joseph, Missouri to Sacramento in just 10 days. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl. Now, we do not normally cover new companies on the Italian stock market, but tomorrow's public debut of Moleskine is something special. The company is based in Milan, and it's found its niche selling notebooks. Now, not the computer kind, the old-fashioned kind. And they're modeled on the notebooks used by artists like Van Gogh, Picasso, and Hemingway. So far, Moleskine's IPO has raised more than $300 million. But public companies have to keep growing to keep shareholders happy. So why does a company built on paper think it has a future in the digital age? Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
Shopping at Midtown's Time Warner Center is a high-end affair with stores like Coach and Hugo Boss. The newest resident is Moleskine. Its first U.S. store is in a kiosk just inside the main entrance. Before we go in, let's clear something up. I said Moleskine. You can say Moleskine, 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 or whatever you want. The company has no official pronunciation.
This side we've got in ruled and plain and checked graph paper.
Step inside and staffers can show you Moleskine notebooks in every size and color, not just the best known black ones. Some have themes, style, music, restaurants, pets. Eric Grocock is shopping with his girlfriend.
They never had these smaller ones in the past.
But you'll fill them up really quickly.
He pronounces it
Moleskine.
He's a huge fan, carrying multiple notebooks at a time.
The colored ones are usually the ones that I put supposedly better ideas into, and then the black ones are more just like notes in general.
Your total is 1410.
He bought a green one to replace a red notebook he lost. An IT professional with an entrepreneurial bent, he likes to jot down ideas for startup businesses. You might not expect a digital native to be a notebook enthusiast, but NYU marketing professor Scott Galloway isn't surprised. He pronounces the brand
Moleskine.
Galloway has founded several businesses and meets often with tech execs. He says the older ones brandish iPads, perhaps hoping to look hip.
The younger digital executives oftentimes show up with a notebook similar to the ones that this company is selling.
Those notebooks are nearly all of the business, but the company also has digital offerings like its app and notebooks linked with smartphones. Moleskine isn't selling itself to investors as a stationary company. It wants to be known as a luxury brand. That's how Deb Johnson thinks of it.
I say Moleskine.
She teaches design at Pratt Institute, where her office has dozens of sketch-filled black Moleskine notebooks shelved above her desk.
It is something that's very desirable. It may be a little bit more expensive, but it's something that becomes more precious, not only because it's a beautiful object, but because it's capturing parts of your life.
That beauty comes with a high price tag, but the cost is about much more than materials.
I would call it Moleskine.
P.K. Kanan is a University of Maryland marketing professor.
The brand should be appealing closer to a customer's sense of identity rather than looking at it as a functional product where you take a notebook and write something down.
Owning a Moleskine sends the message that you're the type of person who owns a Moleskine. Barbara Kahn is a University of Pennsylvania business professor with an interest in brand loyalty.
It's so consistent in its execution that people know it's a Moleskine without even seeing the brand name. So it's kind of a status symbol.
Oh, and her pronunciation?
Maybe Moleskine is better, but I usually say Moleskine.
The company hopes to hear it pronounced in a host of accents as it expands beyond its core markets in Europe and North America. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
For those of you who haven't been swept up by March Madness, here's an update. The Final Four this Saturday, Wichita State versus Louisville and Michigan against Syracuse. But why am I giving you a basketball update on a business show? Well, college sports is big business, and you can get dizzy trying to keep up with all the schools changing conferences in a chase for bigger TV revenues. Bob Bowlesby is commissioner of the Big 12. We're talking teams like Baylor, Kansas, Texas, and Texas Tech. Mr. Bowlesby, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So your conference, the Big 12, now has 10 teams, as I understand it. At one point, you had fewer than that. Why all the changes?
Well, you know, one of the ironies in college athletics right now is that the Big 12 has 10, and the Big 10 is soon going to have 14. So
right.
We're numerically challenged. But besides that, we have 10 members that we think has the right composition for the group of schools that we find aggregated. And so that's where we're going to stay for a while.
Now, I have read that a lot of major schools are getting big TV contracts or their own regional networks. How is that playing into all these conference realignments right now?
Well, there isn't any question that the television and media money is what's driving the realignment right now. And in my opinion, there are some very bad decisions that are being made by certain institutions based only on the money and not on traditions of rivalries and what may be best for the institution in other ways.
Give me an example of that. What's a bad decision recently?
Well, I think that the departures from our league, the departures of Missouri and Texas A&M, cause many people to have consternation about rivalries in football and men's and women's basketball that go back 100 years. And the additions of Maryland and Rutgers to the Big Ten are not completely understandable from a competitive standpoint, but certainly are understandable in the context of a business lens, which is the Washington, D.C. market and the New York, New Jersey market will deliver lots of cable subscribers.
Yeah. Explain this for people who may not be following this that closely. How much of this landscape shifting in the conferences, all this musical chairs going on, is about the sports themselves? I mean, are there conferences that are trying to gain strength because of football specifically?
Well, the popularity of football is really what's driving it. There isn't any question about that. And I think a good example that doesn't pertain to my league but to the Atlantic Coast Conference, I think what they found with the reorganization that the Atlantic Coast Conference is experiencing is that the majority of the value, even for a league that has the most storied tradition in men's basketball, the majority of the value in their media contracts is driven by the sport of football.
You know, when I think about all this conference realignment and the business of college sports, it does remind me of, you know, sort of an era of mergers and acquisitions. Do you think of yourself as a CEO or a commissioner?
Well, a little bit of both. It depends on what day. I think that some of the mergers and acquisitions thinking is probably apropos on this occasion. And I think that's unfortunate because what we've done is we've commoditized institutions of higher education. And I don't think that that's a path down which we really want to go. But that's what's happened. And it's about driving media subscriptions. And, you know, you wonder at some point, are there going to be those four super conferences or is there going to be one or two large, very large organizations that close everybody else out?
So we have to ask you before you go, Final Four this weekend, Monday, the championship. Who's going to win it all?
Well, I'm certainly not going to get into the business of prognosticating. I am regretful that the Kansas Jayhawks weren't able to play their way through the regional and be our representative there. But, you know, I think there are some great storylines with this Final Four.
Bob Bowlsby is commissioner of the Big 12. Mr. Bowlsby, thanks a lot.
It's been my pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
And if you want to hear what the commissioner has to say about how much college coaches get paid these days, just go to marketplace.org. Since we were talking college sports today, we couldn't resist having a little fun on Twitter. No matter your conference, old rivalries, of course, die hard. We asked you for your favorite insults for your college rivals.
Ohio Suckeyes. Go Blue!
Question, how do you get a U of M graduate off your front porch? Answer, pay him for the pizza. Go Buckeyes!
Don't ruin your life.
USC, more like University of Spoiled Children.
University of Northern Colorado equals University of No Credit.
What's the only sign of intelligent life in Chapel Hill? Duke University, 12 miles ahead.
2, 4, 6, 8, God is dead and Nietzsche's great.
Colgate sucks. That's all we had at Hamilton College.
Okay, so I heard USC and UCLA, Ohio State and Michigan, and I think that Nietzsche one is Reed College in Oregon. If you want to weigh in, hit us up on Twitter. We're at Marketplace APN.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And finally, did you know that wedge of aged cheddar you've got in your fridge is a high-risk food? According to the Center for Retail Research in Britain, cheese is the world's most stolen food item, more than meat, more than baby formula. Cheese stealing is especially popular in Europe, apparently, because, as one security expert put it, you know, Europeans love their cheese. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 89 points, 0.6%. The NASDAQ charged up 15 points, 0.5%. And the S&P 500 rose 8 points, also 0.5%. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Lina Anwar, Katie Long, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rada Bead. I'm Sarah Gardner. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.